Welcome to the Western Bowhunter Podcast with your host, South Cox of Stalker Stick Bows.
Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast. This is South Cox, and I'm excited to have on today a friend of mine, a trad bow guy, Scott Hargrove, and you're down out of Crested Butte, Colorado, kind of south central or maybe a little bit west of central there, right, Scott?
Yes, sir. Crested Butte, Colorado. I'm looking out the window at some beautiful high country mountains, waiting for the snow to melt and the bucks to get up here so we can scout them.
And you guys have one of the unenviable distinctions of being frequently the coldest spot in the United States, at least in the lower 48, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. But other than those very few cold days, it's beautiful.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. You texted me a picture out your office window the other day, and you could have framed it and put it on the wall. Pretty beautiful spot.
Yeah, it's a nice place to live. Colorado's awesome.
Yeah. Now, you like me, are a transplant, though. I mean, you're darn near native because of the duration of time that you've been here, but we both started our lives there in California. Why don't you talk a little bit about maybe, you know, how long ago it was when you moved, and then what was the motivation from pulling out of California and moving to Colorado?
Sure. We moved to Colorado 25 years ago from Southern California, and really a couple of reasons. Got lucky. My wife's folks moved here, so we came to visit them quite often, and both summer and winter. And as we were driving back into the LA basin, looked at each other, my wife and I, and said, what are we doing? Mm-hmm. You know, so we kind of worked it out slowly to have this opportunity. Our kids were very young, and we kind of thought, well, we have to do it while they're at a young age or wait until they get out of all their school activities and sports. So as a builder, we kind of were able to move our business here to Colorado and reestablish it. And it was a dream come true for me to be able to live in the mountains and raise my family here.
Yeah, I lived in the northern end of the state, but I can say from the many times, or not many, but the too many times I visited Southern California, I think you made a good move. It took me a lot longer to make that decision to get out here to Colorado myself, and I suspect that if I lived in Southern California, maybe that would have happened a lot sooner. But I don't regret it. Now, why Colorado? I mean, if you're moving out to be next to your in-laws there, that made a lot of sense.
Yeah, well, we had come here. We kind of learned the area, fell in love with it. And yes, the in-laws being here were a big reason. And once you get to know it and you get to know people and establish relationships, It was a great opportunity.
That was probably before the stigma, you know, with Californians existed, or at least to the depth that it does now, huh?
Yeah, I think so. But it's more of a joke, I think.
Sure.
Most of us are transplants.
Yeah. So. No, it's. I wish more of the conservative part of California would leave California and come over here to Colorado to kind of upset the balance that seems to be happening here, but I guess I can say I did my part by moving over here.
Yeah, we did the same. And there's a big difference between Western Colorado and in some of the Front Range, but it's a marvelous place. It's just an awesome place to live. And
yeah,
we're lucky
no doubt
every
about
day.
It. So why don't you tell me a little bit about the early years hunting here in Colorado? Cause I mean, you've been a bow hunter. Well, why don't you give me a little bit of a background on your history as a bow hunter, how you got into it, and then how long you've been shooting a stick and all that.
My dad got into bow hunting actually at the Bow Hut in Pasadena, and I think Jim Doherty or Bill Krenz were there. Probably Jim Doherty. Maybe even Doug Kittredge, because that was, you know, probably in the 50s. So I got interested in archery through my father and just became addicted, passionate archer. And really, since I was about 12 years old, it's been my my passion and my favorite outdoor activity. So I grew up hunting in Southern California and got lucky enough to go out to the islands and hunt pigs and goats like you did, and the California blacktails. And as we, you know, evolve and grow as hunters, you know, I had got to go to Nevada and Colorado, and, you know, fell in love with the mountains and the high country. So when we did get an opportunity to move here, after hunting deer my whole life, elk were just like, oh my gosh, these big, amazing animals that scream at you. So I hunted elk the first, I'd say 5 years with a passion, and you know, had moderate success. But when I was up hunting the elk, I'd see these humongous velvet mule deer, and oh my gosh, it just, you know, really was kind of got me going. So I kind of got a passion for the mule deer and really ended up hunting mule deer much more, spend more time pursuing mule deer the last 20 years than I did elk.
And that being said, I mean, you've put quite a number of elk in the freezer along the way.
Yeah, I think I've killed 17 bulls. So a couple of them in conjunction with mule deer hunting, and, you know, and opportunities arise, so you take advantage of them for sure. The elk are, both mule deer and elk, I think, are great table fare. So, and they're both amazing. But I was definitely focused on elk early on. And I've really noticed a difference in the elk hunting. I think that there's bigger bulls in Colorado from what I've seen now than when I moved here. More bigger bulls. I think we've had some late warm falls in the last, almost last 10 years that have limited the rifle harvest. And I also, it seems to me like more people are riding their four-wheelers around and not really getting out and getting with it in the rifle seasons where they really actually harvest the elk. I mean, archers don't do as much, you know, damage as far as reducing the elk herd. So I've noticed bigger bulls the last five years.
Well, that's encouraging. And how about elk numbers in general terms?
I think they've stabilized. It seems to me like they went up a little, you know, 10 years ago, and now maybe there's a few less. I think the Department of Wildlife does a wonderful job of monitoring and keeping a balance. It's not perfect because you're dealing with so many factors, but all in all, we have an amazing elk herd. I mean, just a lot of elk. You can see them. You know, they're very, very difficult, but I think we have great elk hunting.
Yeah. Well, let's take this opportunity to segue into, I get, you know, people hitting me up from time to time asking me, you know, I'm coming from back east and I've never hunted Colorado, never hunted elk. I want to come out. I say, well, I've got a 10-day, you know, a 10-day chunk of time that I can hunt elk. I'm willing to, you know, backpack in and then, you know, say for five days and come back out midway, resupply on food, go back in so I can get off the roads a bit. But I'm at a loss as to where to go. So if you were in this person's shoes and let's do two scenarios. One that you have, you know, you have a, let's say a 4-day timeline in the summer that you could fly out, rent a car, and maybe get in a quick scouting trip. And then the other scenario that you are not able to, how would you approach it as far as looking for, you know, a spot to hunt? And we're assuming that you have zero bonus points, so you're going to be buying an over-the-counter tag.
Okay, so you got zero bonus points. First thing I would recommend is do your best to build the bonus points. There's a lot of areas in Colorado that you can hunt over the counter that are just great. In the meantime, get a point so that 5 to 10, 7 years, you have just an amazing elk hunt. So that'd be my first recommendation. First scenario is you have some time to scout. So you're going to backpack in. You're looking for a wilderness area.
Which there are quite a number of in Colorado, fortunately.
There sure are. There's just great wilderness areas and great elk hunting in them too, especially if you're willing to hike. Really, you don't have to go that far, 3-4 miles. Sometimes if you hike in too far in the really big wilderness areas, I think you run into a lot of the horse guys that'll go in 10, 15, miles. So that sometimes that in-between zone, 3 to 7 miles can be a little bit of a sleeper as far as, you know, away from the roads, but not in where the outfitters are, depending on the wilderness areas. So if you can get out and scout, that's the ideal. So look for a wilderness area, look for some north-facing timber. Really, any of the wilderness areas in Colorado hold elk. So elk need what any animal needs: food, water, cover. In the summer, you're scouting, they're going to be up high. I would be at timberline, I'd be take my binoculars, I'd be up at first light. And when I do glass, I like to try to plan ahead and make sure that the sun's at my back. So I'm looking as the sun illuminates the mountains and the hillside and not in my eyes, because it makes a huge difference in what you're able to see. But the elk will be high and they'll be in their summer mode. And you can really get a feel for what's there as far as the quality of bulls, how many, how the elk herd's looking. So, and you get yourself in shape, and it's a huge advantage to be able to come out and scout. There's just no question about it. If you can't scout, then you're doing your scouting on, Onyx Hunt or Topo Map.
Before you go too much further there, let me just interject with another question here. So, okay, let's say that you get out there, you locate some bulls in their summer, kind of their summer routine. In your experience, realizing that these bulls come season are going to be moving, dropping into the timber and going to be more in a fall kind of rutting behavior, and they're not going to necessarily be up there above timberline. Now, for the sake of my experience, that first week of bow season, I'm usually up, in the alpine hunting mule deer, and oftentimes I will still see them in that kind of summer range habitat as they transition, down into the timber. But let's say you were going that second week of the season and maybe not the first week. Typically, do you see those elk moving a long distance to get into, the area where the cows are, where they normally rut, as opposed to their summer range where they're spend more time up there in the alpine above timberline?
Yes, for sure. Those bulls are in bachelor groups in the summer and kind of really mostly separate from the cows and calves. And as they transition towards fall, they will shed their velvet starting pretty much the 1st of August. So by the end of August, they'll be shed and pretty much ready to start going into rut. 1st of September, I'm sorry. Each week is different. The first week, they are up high. They'll be just transitioning from bachelor groups and trying to feel their oats, rub their antlers. Second week, which I think is a great week, they'll be moving a little more into the timber, searching for cows, and moving toward a rutting zone. And there are very specific rutting areas. And sometimes they're a little harder to find, but as you get to know an area, which I would recommend learning, picking an area and sticking with it, because you will really learn the little pockets and secrets. But the elk will definitely move down into the timber more. That high country kind of burns off mid-September-ish as far as the frost will come, and some of that growth will get a little brown and not be quite the same. That being said, I still think there's elk up there or really close to it until pretty much the end of the season. But as the season progresses with elk, the bulls try to gather up cows and, you know, fight for them and challenge each other. And then they will try and push those cows away from the other bulls and hide them away in a little hidey hole, sometimes a really high little bench or a little high pocket, or sometimes way deep in a canyon. And if you can find it, it's great, but sometimes it gets a little harder. So I do like that second week. I think that's a great time. And I do think that the bulls will have moved down out of timberline at least a little ways, looking for their cows and getting into timber.
So that second week is that week before the muzzleloader season opens, isn't that right?
That's correct, yep.
Okay, so if you hunted a 9-day, weekend to weekend, that second weekend, then you would be overlapping opening weekend of muzzleloader season on your last weekend in the mountains. What have you found much intrusion from the muzzleloader hunters? We have the benefit of, and I actually honestly haven't looked at the muzzleloader tags, but there are a lot of over-the-counter units, and this is kind of what we're talking about right now for archery. Do the muzzleloader hunters have that same benefit of having over-the-counter units, or are they limited to draw only across the state? Do you know that?
You know, I'm 90% sure that all muzzleloader tags are a draw.
Okay.
I don't muzzleloader hunt, and I haven't paid, you know, super close attention, but I'm pretty darn sure that it's all a draw, and there's fewer tags. Mm-hmm. And I have really not experienced a huge problem with muzzleloaders in general. I find in my area, which is not over the counter, but it's really close, they allot a lot of tags, that the elk become a little shyer after that muzzleloader season, because they have archers and muzzleloaders out there bumping them and messing with them and getting them, you know, more used to human, and especially with the calls. Once they get fooled, they realize that the next elk call may not be an elk, and they're not always going to come in or respond. Mm-hmm. So it depends on where you're hunting. Some areas have a few more, and I also feel that getting back into a remote spot is the best way to go, for sure.
Yeah, or even getting just off of a trail system, too. I mean, sometimes, like you'd pointed out, you know, going in 3 to 4 miles is fine, but if you post up 3 or 4 miles in and you're right off of a trail, or in an area with a heavy network of trails, you're going to see more people than if you go into a spot that is, has, you know, a much sparser trail system, and then you relocate yourself off of those trails, or, you know, take a main trail in and then run a ridge line out or something like that. And then that offers you maybe multiple canyons, but no trail access into those canyons. And you're going to be a lot better off than just running trails.
No question. Those elk, after a while, realize where the hunters are. And I lost my train of thought there. But if you're by trails, I do think there's a lot more people. And what I was going to say is a lot of people are really afraid to get away from a trail or get mm-hmm. off into the country that's unmarked, afraid
right.
to get lost.
Right.
Or I should say afraid they'll get lost. And so I think you're right for sure, that getting away from the trails and getting back into some more deep pockets and some of those scary, really steep blowdown country. Those elk know they're safe in there, and that's a fantastic place to hunt. A little tougher to get them out once you get one, but I usually kind of cross up ridge when I get to it.
Right.
Not always wisely, but...
Yeah. Well, the perspective that I take on it is, you know, if I'm glassing up a buck across a canyon and just like, oh, man, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to even go over there because it's going to, you know, kill me to get over there. And then, you know, let alone shooting him over there and then having to pack him back. But you think about it in the perspective of, okay, if I don't stalk that buck or bull, in this case, over there or make a play at it, then, you know, I may hunt the next week and not have another opportunity, and think of the energy expended in a week, you know, running around the mountains trying to find something versus I've got something right there that I know is there. Yeah, it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be fun, but, you know, it's going to be a much easier, you know, hike getting over there and back than it is going to be for the next 3, 4, 5, 7 days of running around the mountains. And so sometimes, you know, if I'm hesitant, you know, looking at them, then that's, I'll use that, you know, argument to myself to motivate myself to get over there.
You know, I agree 1,000%. The other motivation I've used is I think of mid-January, sit at home, watching the snow pile up. It's cold outside, and what will I wish I would have done?
Right, 100%.
Sit there saying, I wish I had have gone down that canyon, up the other side, got in there, and at least tried to make it happen. Because after 3 days of climbing those hills, sometimes you can talk yourself out of opportunities. I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. A good example of that is 2 years ago, opening morning, I was sitting on our glassing spot there in Colorado, and I had an elk tag in my pocket. And of course I was, you know, chasing mule deer. So the elk tag was second fiddle there. And, none of the bucks that we had glassed up bedded in a spot that I could stalk them. And meanwhile, I'm glassing clear across the canyon miles away. And I see this, you know, probably 300 class bull. And this is in an over the counter unit for elk. He was up there in the, you know, above timberline, up in a big open meadow. And I watch him, as I'm, you know, glassing for deer, I'm constantly watching, kind of monitoring this big bull, and he was with some cows. But then he broke off from the cows and went and bedded down in this triangular strip of timber. And, you know, I didn't see exactly where he bedded, but this strip of timber was, you know, maybe 100 yards long. So I've got a pretty good idea that, you know, where he is. And once he went into that patch of timber, I really watched it for like the next hour, and he never came back out. So I'm sitting up there on the top of the ridge and no, you know, nothing to do for chasing deer. And I had that mental, you know, quandary there, if you will. And I'm sitting there looking at that patch of timber, and I'm, you know, going, man, that is, you know, if you are a spot and stalk kind of hunter, like I am, I mean, what better play to have on any kind of animal, especially one that, like, I haven't spent a lot of time practicing calling and all that. So, it was a kind of a tailor-made situation for somebody like me, and I let that opportunity go by. And I kicked myself the rest of the week, and I've kicked myself the rest of the following year, and here I am going into, you know, yet another year, and that still haunts me.
Yep. You got to think about it. You got to think, what will I wish I would have done? It's hard, but especially when you know how physically difficult it's going to be. But I agree. I've done that too. I did it last year. It's similar. Big bull, bottom of a canyon, and I saw him, and I talked myself out of it, and I'm sitting there saying, man, what a dummy. I should have gone down there.
Right.
But those are the things you got to learn, and you got to think that through carefully, because there aren't that many opportunities sometimes.
Yeah. So what's your thoughts on, you know, on hunting wilderness areas versus national forests, for elk? Is you pretty much try to restrict your hunting to, you know, those wilderness areas, or do you spend much time on the national forests?
I have in the past always gone in the wilderness area. For one thing, I just love it. You know, it's just a grand adventure. Mm-hmm. That being said, I think there are plenty of elk in the National Forest. They pretty much get used to roads and people, and they kind of know, you know, where to kind of stay away from. And they also know what times, you know. They know that at, you know, 5, 6, right at daybreak, the roads get busy or hunters come out, and they kind of learn what to avoid. I mean, I think they're remarkably smart. And I think there's some great areas in the National Forest. You just have to kind of search those pockets out. I actually think there's some great areas right along some of the main highways, you know, I-70, places that no one would go, you know, and especially if you got to drop down a steep hillside and cross a larger creek or river, you know, where it's just difficult. And
right.
So there are definitely plenty of elk in non-wilderness areas. But it takes some time and it takes some searching and patience for sure.
So what would your advice be? I mean, you know, to a guy coming from back east or, you know, just the kind of the mental thought process, would you, you know, let's say, okay, I didn't have that 4-day scouting trip and I'm coming out for 9 days, never hunted elk. You know, is it better to think of kind of have that mental mindset, not that you don't want to be, you know, anticipating success, but to approach it as, okay, I'm going to spend, you know, my 9-day trip out here and I'm going to, you know, with the kind of the focus of covering a lot of ground, getting to know my hunting area, getting familiar with elk habits and I'm going to, you know, burn that 600 and whatever to 60 or 70 bucks for an elk tag. But I'm going to look at this as a long-term investment, you know, and not something that I'm going to, you know, be crushed if I don't come out and fill a tag on that first trip out.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a grand adventure no matter what. But you know, as much research as you can do, and elk, there's been a lot written up. Elk really like the moist north facing slopes. So you can find those, you know, on Google Maps and do plenty of research and try to plan your time where they're, especially if there's some above timberline country and then some benches and north facing slopes and some water and really I think elk like really good cover, thick timber generally in an over the counter unit where there's going to be some pressure, and you can find those things and I think you can do well searching it out, and there's nothing better than boots on the ground and getting out and just hiking and walking and doing your best to hunt right, keep the wind in your face so you're not just spoiling the area as you walk as much as possible, and glass it, you know, getting up early, getting up above timberline and glassing right on the edge of timberline, right where that moist seeps are, and that they elk eat, you know, grass and forbs. They want to be out in those meadowy areas where that new growth is growing and where they can, you know, stock up on goodies for the, you know, to live and for the winter. So they're definitely feeding. You can find them.
Yeah. Some advice that I might offer too is, you know, if you're planning on going into some of those wilderness areas and packing way back in, and you're going on foot, you do some little bit of research ahead of time and find the, you know, local packers that are working that area in case you get a bull down that's way back in there in a bad spot. You know, it'd be worth that $300 or $400 to have a guy come in and haul that out for you rather than, you know, doing 3 backbreaking trips, you know, pulling 70 pounds of, you know, meat a haul there. You know, one trip in and out and a horse can, you know, pull a decent sized bull out of there for you. You know, or if you're going to restrict it to, you know, 3 or 4 miles back in, then it's not quite as bad. But if you're going to go in really deep, you know, and it's warm weather and you're looking at, you know, 10 miles in, or rather 10 miles out, your first load, 10 miles back in to get to the second load, 10 miles back out. I mean, you're starting to look at meat spoilage there by the time you're able to haul it all out.
Yeah, it's definitely a, a serious job. And you can contact the local meat packing plant. Sometimes they'll know a packer or the local outfitters. A lot of them are willing to do it. And I think it's worth its weight in gold, especially as I get a little older here. I've certainly packed my share of elk out and felt tough for it, but you know, it beats you up. That's for sure. And it also, you know, makes it harder. If you hunt with a buddy, somebody gets an elk down, two of you pack it out, it kind of takes the wind out of your sails. Now you don't have a lot of get up and go sometimes to get back out there. So I love that idea, if there's any way you can do it.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, to leave a little bit of extra money in the budget for that is a good idea. Because like you'd pointed out, I mean, if you're, you know, if two guys are going out there and you've saved up all year for this, you know, 9-day stretch and someone shoots a bull on, let's say, the third day, and then you have 2 or 3 days of pack and meat out, that's, you know, 2 or 3 days of your productive hunting time that you could have been hunting. And you got to put a value on that time. You know, not that, I mean, packing meat is part of the trip and it is, you know, a pleasurable experience, but if you shoot a mule deer and you have, well, I should say pleasurable. I mean, you laugh there. It's been a while since I packed an elk on my back. I'm not going to lie.
It's like a lot of things, you know, it's like going to the gym. Yeah. And it's great when you're done and you feel good about having accomplished something, but it can be miserable in that moment. Yeah.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So, but anyway, you know, kind of if you're spending a third of your vacation packing meat, that might not be, you know, the most productive way to spend it as far as putting that second elk on the ground. And that is a strong argument for enlisting the services of a packer there.
Yep. I would vote for that for sure.
Yeah. So let's transition now. Let's say, you know, it's not elk that you're hunting, but mule deer. And of course, you know, in Colorado, all the mule deer hunting is a draw. So pretty much every unit, you're going to need at least one point to draw. And there are quite a few units there that you can draw with one point, but let's take this from, you know, same scenario. You have 9 days to go out. You've never stepped foot in Colorado before. What are you going to be looking for, for a mule deer hunt? And if you had that 4 days of scouting, kind of how would your two approaches differ?
Well, there's kind of what I would consider three areas to hunt mule deer in Colorado. You can kind of hunt the sagebrush and pinyons. You can hunt the Aspen Plateaus, or you can hunt the high country. And there's plenty of mule deer in each area, and there's big mule deer in each area. I have focused on the high country because I love it. I want to say it's easy to find bucks. They stand out. It's not always easy, but they're in pockets. But if we're specifically talking about the high country, in their summer coats, they stand out at first light. So if I've got 9 days I want to hunt, I'm going to look for an above, for me, I'm going to look for an above timberline area. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to kind of, they like bucks like willows. They need the same thing elk need. They need an escape route. They need water. They need food. And they're in their summer mode when we're hunting them. So they're in bachelor groups up high. Really the majority of it is glassing and getting high up on a ridge and spotting them and kind of watching their patterns and their movements. Excuse me, I'm just getting over a cold here, so I got a little frog. So if I've got the 9 days, I'm going to identify my area. And I think pretty much all the above timberline areas in Colorado hold good bucks in pockets. Mm-hmm. You've hunted a lot of bucks, and that's kind of your passion. They're not everywhere, but when you can find a pocket, I find it a little like fishing. If there's a little hole, then there's always a big fish in that hole. And so these bucks like certain areas for reasons, and if you can find those pockets, and again, I find them by glassing and with a spotting scope and at first light when they really stand out.
So it pretty much goes without saying, obviously, you know, you're spending a lot of time behind your glass, and you know, the importance of quality glass has been, you know, covered to death. But why don't you tell me what your personal setup is as far as a tripod and rather a spotting scope. Well, yeah, tripod, spotting scope, and binoculars. What do you use?
I have Swarovski. Okay. I have 10 by 40 binoculars that I just think are great. And then mm-hmm. I have the 65 mm Swarovski spotting scope that mm-hmm. goes like 20 power to 60 power, I think. And I mean, they are both on a tripod. I don't use the binocular tripod probably as much as I should, but definitely the spotting scope. I'm sitting there looking first with my binoculars, just a scan, mm-hmm. trying to pick up something obvious, and then focusing in on it with my spotting scope. Okay, there's a couple bucks right there, mile and a half away. Zero in and kind of see what they look like and in the area they're in. If I'm actually hunting, I'm just kind of scanning and scoping it out for opportunities. You know, you want to, you know, you need to have some cover. You need to be able to get around above them. Pretty much you're not sneaking up on a buck from underneath for the most part, and usually waiting till that wind gets moving uphill and it gets much more consistent. So you have, you know, you're not going to blow them out by them smelling you ahead of time. So my optics are the Swarovski 10 by 40s and the spotting scope. And I think they work great.
Yeah, that's pretty much the same setup that I'm running myself, is that 65 millimeter Swarovski. And actually, I've been using a pair of 12 by 50s the last few years, and they are, I mean, what a nice setup that is. It's just a little bit more in magnification than the 10s, but I spend a good portion of the time with them on the tripod. And then if I'm just, you know, trying to do something quick, it's, you know, elbows on the knees and in a sitting position. But yeah, putting them on a tripod is a great way to do it. And what's your, you know, if you're going to be focused your 9 days, what part of the season are you going to be putting that 9 days to work at?
Well, for mule deer, absolutely the first week. Mm-hmm. They're up high, they're visible, they're still in velvet, and the weather's nicer generally.
Yeah.
And I'd give 2 or 3 of those days to scouting ahead of time and just getting acclimated, mm-hmm. just coming out and not killing myself right off the bat and wearing myself down to where I couldn't continue for the entire time. Because acclimating is huge when you're hunting at high altitude, pretty much 11 to 12,000 feet for high country mule deer. So I've got buddies that come out and I try to get them out 3 days ahead of time. Just, you know, relax for a day and drink plenty of water and then do a little hike and then we'll go do a scout, but just kind of find bucks, but also get used to the high thin air.
Yeah. I, you know, living in California, I live just barely above sea level and I would go, you know, directly from home. So I'd leave home Thursday morning. I'd fly, you know, to Salt Lake or Denver. And then I would be at the trailhead usually that Thursday night. And then I'd start hiking, you know, Friday morning, anywhere from, you know, usually trailhead at say 5,000 to 8,000 feet and then going up from there. And so by Friday night, which was, you know, what, 36 hours later, I was sitting anywhere from 10 to 12,000 feet in elevation. And my typical, you know, headache first night, you know, having a hard time sleeping, some insomnia, and it beats you up for sure. I mean, for one, you're not getting a lot of rest there. And then you are, you know, going from almost zero elevation to 10 or 12,000 feet. And that acclimation is kind of by fire.
not
the smartest approach, but there are, you know, some definite signs of altitude sickness, though mild in my case, but it can be much more severe in people that are more sensitive to it.
Yeah, it can be. It is something to be aware of. You know, and it's hard sometimes to have time. You know, we all got to work. We all have families and limited time. But any time ahead of time that you can give it and take it a little slow is helpful.
Yeah, particularly if you've never really been at that kind of elevation, it would be smarter, you know, to kind of ease into it so that if you, you know, end up being one of those people that that are more sensitive to elevation, changes in elevation. My kids, for example, two of the three of them are much more sensitive, and they had problems throwing up and stuff when we went from, you know, sea level and then went up, you know, relatively rapidly in, you know, up to 10,000 feet. And so that's something I have to be more cognizant of. Now we live, you know, at 7,500, the kids do just fine. But if we were to, you know, go back to sea level and then all of a sudden spring them back up to 10,000 again, then I'd, you know, I'd want to be looking at the same kind of precautions.
Mm-hmm. Drink a lot of fluid and get as much rest as you can and avoid alcohol.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And, I would totally agree with you on that opening week. I mean, that honestly, that's the only week I've ever hunted Colorado is that opening week of archery, you know, before they shed out of velvet. And it kind of actually, interestingly enough, I actually saw a buck strip his velvet, and I want to say it was opening weekend last year, which I've only seen in, I don't know how many years I've hunted Colorado. It's been, you know, probably pushing 15 now. That was only the second deer that I'd seen hard horned during archery season. The other one I watched strip, it was like September 3rd. And this year, archery season opens August 25th, which is really early. Typically, it's that last Saturday falls closer to the end of the month. So I wouldn't anticipate seeing too many deer hard horned, or any maybe even by the end of, you know, the end of that opening week of archery. And actually last year, my brother-in-law shot a really nice buck. I don't remember if it was opening weekend of muzzleloader or if it was somewhere right in that kind of time frame there, but it was, I was pretty surprised it was still in velvet at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think they kind of generally start shedding about mid season. So if you could find them shedding, sometimes they get so preoccupied, I think you could really do well sneaking up on them. I've tried it. I saw a really tremendous buck shedding his velvet and really focused on it. And I mean, he spent a lot of time with his head in the bush just tearing it up. And I got above him and was trying to get down on him. And I did get really close, but there was another buck bedded that I didn't see that jumped up and alerted him and spoiled my plans. But I've always thought if you could find one shedding, and I think it'd be like finding a bull elk rubbing a tree. They close their eyes, and you can cover some ground and get close. Not totally fair, but what the heck.
Right. I've missed some opportunities at elk, you know, when they're raking, and I should have been running, you know, towards them. And yeah, that'd be a good time to take advantage of a situation like that for sure. All right. So let's see on mule deer. Let me think about, one of the other things that I really, focus, you know, if I'm looking for, you know, a new area, I'm really focused because I'm hunting with a stick bow on looking for country with broken topography. You know, so if you have, you know, an area above timberline, but you're looking at these big slick, you know, hills with very little, you know, broken topography, rocks, or, you know, little ditches or fingers or what have you, or basins, the same thing, a smooth walled basin, without the benefit of some willow patches or, some avalanche chutes or something that's going to give you something to hide in, and use for an approach. That's one of the things I really focus my efforts on.
Yeah, there's no question that terrain and topography make a huge difference. And honestly, I've come to where I almost hunt a spot more than I hunt a buck. an area that's conducive, and I'm a stick bow shooter too, so I, you know, I'm going to be 20 yards, 25 yards. So you need cover. You need places where you can get out of sight because you're, you know, I mean, they are so wired that last distance when you're trying to close them, you know, the 60, the 100 to 20 is, you know, striking distance. So topography makes a huge difference for sure. I really like those cliff bands and boulder areas and broken country, little bit of timber.
That's something I definitely, you know, agree with you on there. I have the advantage of having a couple of hunting partners that I've been hunting in Colorado with the last couple of years that hunt with compounds. And so, you know, it's the areas where the topography is favorable for me. I kind of post up there and hunt those spots. And then the areas where there's not as much cover to get in close, then those guys will kind of focus their efforts there. And, or, you know, like you'd pointed out, I mean, you're hunting the terrain almost more so than you're hunting the animal. And, I will actually focus on, you know, same thing as you, looking for those cliff bands and, that terrain that has, you know, that what I call micro topography. But by the same token, you have to be careful, you know, not to overlook even some of those basins that, you know, at first glance look like they're not possible to put a stalk on. I shot a really nice buck 2 years ago in a basin that, you know, I'd look into every year just, you know, to see what was there, but never really gave it a whole lot of thought about stalking something in there because it didn't really look possible. And then the more I spotted this, you know, group of nice bucks and the more I sat down and really kind of dissected it, I was able to pick out a route and ended up shooting a buck at, I don't know, it was like 15 yards or something, out of a willow patch there. And, the more you get familiar, the more stalks you go on, the more you'll realize what you can and can't get away with and what you can and can't do.
Yeah, you're right. When you're looking at it from across the canyon, sometimes it looks a lot flatter than it really is. And there's more little dips and nooks and crannies. And if you just study it, really take the time, you're right, you can make it happen sometimes. And sometimes you can surprise yourself. And,
right,
you know, you just got to go for it and learn that. Something I've done recently when I've found a buck and feel like this is possible and I'm going to go for it and try to get over there and make a stalk is I take a picture with my cell phone. So now I get, because it looks way different when you get over there and you're looking at it from above rather than from across the canyon. You're trying to remember, well, the buck was right by this group of three trees and 20 yards below the boulder, and you get over there, well, there's 20 groups of three trees and 100 boulders, and holy moly, which one is he under, you know? So I used to draw a little map, you know, on a little notebook, but now I just take a picture and I can refer to it, and it helps me to remember, oh yeah, those group of three trees was right below that big dead pine.
Yeah, no, it's, I've used that same tactic, and I've forgotten to mention it, so I'm glad you brought that up, but that makes a huge difference.
Yeah, it works well, because it always looks so much different when you get over there.
Yeah, I don't know how many times I've, you know, gotten into an area with strips of rim rock, and, you know, especially if you're dealing with multiple strips and you end up, you know, stalking the wrong strip of rim rock, or worse yet, overrunning it and then, you know, blowing the deer out if you, you know, don't realize that the rim rock that he's under is closer to you than what you figure.
Yep.
That one of the cool things too.
Going too slow.
Yeah. Usually I'm going too fast, but.
Oh, I'm the same way. You get all excited.
Yeah.
So hard to make yourself slow down at those last moments, and it's so important.
Right.
You know, you just want to rush. You're seeing the thing on the wall. You're bragging to your buddies. Oh, my gosh. And then, holy crap, you just blew it out of there. So you have to force yourself to just slow down and be patient at the last. I think there's a time to really go hard and rush, you know, when you're getting there, when you're getting above them before they, they move or a thunderstorm blows in or whatever, but those last, the last three steps.
Yeah. I totally agree with you. And I'm glad you brought that up because it kind of affirms one of my tactics too. And that I've seen a lot of people make the mistake is when you have the benefit of being out of sight and out of hearing range is I cover ground as rapidly as I can, because you know, the longer that deer is sitting there, the greater the chance that he's going to get up and reposition or the wind's going to change or something to that effect. And so I'll hustle as fast as I can while I'm out of sight, try to cover ground as quickly as I can until I get to within that, say, 150 yard range or maybe a little further, depending on how much cover or how much, you know, sound, how much of a sound barrier there is. Like if he's bedded up against a rim rock and you're coming up from above, you've got quite a bit of protection there, particularly if there's a decent uphill thermal going, not much sound is going to reach him when he's tucked in underneath there. And you can move in on him pretty quick up until, like you said, those last few steps. But if he's, you know, bedded, say, behind some willows or something, then you don't have the benefit of that sound barrier and your final approaches might have to be 200 yards out rather than the last, you know, 20 yards or something.
Yeah, and there's no way to learn that stuff but just really by experience.
Right.
And learning, you know, what you can do and what you can get away with, which is almost nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's the truth. Those big bucks, and typically when you blow them out once, you might not see them for the rest of your, you know, 9 days that you have up there in the field.
Yep, they don't get big by being dumb, and they don't like getting surprised by a human being at 20 yards
right.
in their comfort zone.
Now, what's your approach? Let's say you get up tight on a deer and you're not able to get a shot at him. Are you one to sit and wait him out, or are you going to try and lob some pebbles out beyond him to try to get him to stand up, or what's your approach there?
I think it's better to sit and wait for him to stand up.
Mm-hmm.
I've done everything, trying to bleat like a fawn, throwing pebbles, thrown bigger, and usually it doesn't work. That being said, the last buck I killed was in a hailstorm. I snuck up on this buck in a little willow patch at about, it was 12,400 feet, and I got down to 20 yards, and all I could really see was his horns.
Uh-huh.
And I waited, I probably was waiting half an hour, and I had taken my shoes off, so I'm barefooted. And it had been really hot climbing up the other side to get around behind this buck, so I'm in a T-shirt. And in that waiting, a hailstorm came over me and started pounding.
Ouch.
And now I'm standing in hail, I'm freezing, and I just couldn't take it. I literally walked down to 10 yards because the noise was loud from the hail pounding the leaves and him, and he just didn't move. He just was sitting there. And I still couldn't get a shot, so I finally did pick up a baseball-sized rock and toss it over him, and he didn't do anything. It took about three of them. Finally, he stood up, and I shot him. But generally, I think it's better to sit and wait for them to stand unalarmed and take your shot, because usually in a situation where you're throwing, they jump up, and they're wired. Something happened, and it's just. But there's a time and a place for everything.
Yeah, now, I've used that the rock throwing technique, and I think a lot of it depends too, just on the temperament of the deer. I would probably be less inclined to do that on a big old mature deer than I would on, say, a younger one. But then also. I mean, just from state to state, like I don't think I'd ever try that in Nevada. The deer to me just seem to be more wired there than they do here in Colorado. At least that's my personal experience. When you see a deer, blow out from, blow out and then just clears the canyon in Nevada of all the other deer, it's just kind of a next level you know, wariness there. Whereas in Colorado, I've, you know, bumped a deer and seen him run by other, you know, bedded deer. And oftentimes maybe that buck will stand up out of his bed, but then more often than not, he'll, you know, relax and lay back down again, rather than, you know, picking up and running off with the other one. Have you found similar experience?
I have. I hunted Nevada, quite a few years. And it's more remote. There's probably less people, and they don't see people at all. In Colorado, a lot of times there's, you know, climbing the 14ers or hiking some of the trails, and they may be, I think, a little more used to people. And there also may be more lions in Nevada, where they're a little jumpier. But I agree with you there.
So what's your thoughts, Scott, on bonus points? I mean, one of the cool things about Colorado is, you know, as opposed to like Nevada, where, you know, Nevada's obviously got some really good mule deer hunting, but the problem is that, you know, even to get into, well, basically just about any of the, you know, to get in the contention legitimately to draw a tag in Nevada, you're going to need, you know, in that 2, 3, 4 bonus point range. And Colorado has got, you know, for a lot of the good units for archery, you can pull with 1 point. And, you know, recently, I had a friend from Australia that had 6 points that he wanted to cash in and kind of ended up in this awkward situation where he didn't have enough points to draw some of the really premium units in Colorado, but, you know, then to cash in on a 1 point unit seemed like almost a waste of, you know, all those accumulated years of putting in.
I agree. There are great units you can draw in Colorado with 1 and 2 points. And my philosophy is go hunting as much as you can. Get out there, get the experience, and learn, find those units and spend the time to learn them, because there are great bucks in every unit in Colorado. Sometimes if you're from Australia and you can only come once in a while, you know, maybe you are burning some extra points to make sure. And I agree with you. I like about Colorado that you can plan on it. Mm-hmm. You know, this unit takes 2 points. I have 4. I'm going to draw for sure. I'm going to schedule my vacation time. But my philosophy is go hunting as much as you can and get out there. And that experience is worth its weight in gold. Getting stocks under your belt, learning what you can do, and just spending the time up there. So I'm with you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, if you're coming from back east and you're used to hunting whitetails out of a tree stand, you're going to feel really out of your element when you're trying to, you know, sit up there at timberline and use your binoculars as your primary tool for hunting. And then you're spotting and stalking instead of trying to find the right tree to, you know, in a 4 to 100 acre woodlot on, you know, where to kind of, you know, anticipate where that animal is going to be. So it's the more time that you can spend, you know, chasing, whether it be elk or mule deer, then the greater your chances of success are going to be enhanced.
Yep. It's a grand adventure, and we're a great opportunity. We're really lucky to have it available to us.
One of the things too, and just to touch briefly on this, I think that because you're, you know, from a guy from the standpoint of coming from back east to, you know, hunt the west, you're not only you're dealing with a different species, different hunting tactics, you know, vast, huge areas where, you know, you might be concerned about getting lost, but then you're also having to deal with, you know, how am I going to live while I'm up there as far as from a backpack hunting standpoint. And if you're not familiar with that, if you haven't done that before, it's pretty easy to get caught up in the gear trap, you know, that exists in the, you know, backpack hunting world there. And my comment to that would be, you know, don't worry so much about that end of it. I mean, you know, you look at how the Native Americans lived, and they, you know, basically didn't carry anything on their backs. And same with the mountain men. And then if you look at, you know, I've been doing this for, you know, more than 30 years myself. And if I were to, you know, load up a backpack full of my equipment that I had 30 years ago, I'd be laughed out of camp, you know. But the fact is that is, you know, I did just fine with the equipment that I had 30 years ago. And so you don't need to have, you know, $3,000 or $4,000 worth of gear, to survive and be successful up there in the mountains. Really, I mean, you could shop Craigslist and buy, you know, stuff that was 2 or 3 years old on the market, and you'd be light years ahead of the stuff that we had when we were starting out.
Oh, no question. The stuff they make nowadays is so ultralight and so efficient. And I agree, you don't need that much gear. Mm-hmm. You need good boots, but light as you can get them. Mm-hmm. You need some protection. I mean, you're going to get rained on. You're going to get wet. So that's something that I think is pretty important, is to try and have good rain gear and a good... I have a little tarp, uh-huh, a one-pound tarp that I had custom made that I can string up and stay dry and make a pot of top ramen or something if I get a real bad rainstorm or a couple days of rain. But you don't need an enormous amount of gear.
Yeah, no, that's the truth. I mean, really, you know, if you look at it from, you know, basically you're going to need a tent, you're going to need a sleeping pad, a sleeping bag, and a stove. And you can even go, you know, stoveless and just pack in dried food, or, you know, food that doesn't need cooking for preparation. You're going to typically be a little bit heavier, going that route. But if you're doing like a 3-day hike in, you ought to look at the benefits, of going with dried food and being able to axe out the weight of that stove. If you're using, you know, granola and powdered milk, you're eating bars and, maybe you're packing in some bagels and some, you know, condiments to go with that, then you may be able to forego a stove and then lose that extra weight there. But you can get stoves now that are under a pound. So,
oh my gosh, some of the stoves are amazing and they work so well, mm-hmm, and they're so efficient.
Right.
I agree. On a real short overnight or something, I'll skip the stove and take dried food. But if it's starting to get a little longer, I really want that. I really want some good hot food.
Mm-hmm. It does a lot for you mentally to be able to come home or come back to your tent to a hot meal. And then, you know, if you're a coffee drinker, have your coffee or hot chocolate or whatever in the morning, goes a long ways to lift the spirits. And then if you do get, you know, soaked while you're out there hunting during the day, to be able to have a hot meal when you get back to camp makes a big difference there as well.
Oh yeah. It's worth its weight in gold. And I usually throw in some top ramen, mm-hmm, super light, and usually get the opportunity to get a grouse or two and then just cube it up and put it in my top ramen and just have a great, you know, extra meal for some extra protein and stuff I didn't have to pack in there.
Yeah.
Plus it sometimes gives you a little confidence to actually hit something, and then when that buck stands up, you can feel like you can get him.
Right. Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. So transitioning, I wanted to cover another topic here. In a couple of weeks, I'll be 49 and staring at that 50-year mark. You know, if I was looking at that in my 20s, that seemed like a century away. And I can assure, you know, the younger listeners that we have, you know, you basically think you're invincible at that age, you know, in your 20s and maybe even, you know, into and through your 30s. You feel like that's never going to sneak up on you. And I had plenty of people at that, when I was that age, you know, telling me to take care of my body and, you know, eat right and not work so many hours be careful of my knees and yada yada. And it was just like one of those things that was like, yeah, yada yada is kind of what as much, attention as I gave their advice. But I mean, if you've never swung a hammer before in your life and somebody told you that if you hit your thumb with a hammer, it's going to hurt, then you're going to go, obviously, you know, that's pretty clear. You don't need to have done that to know that that's a reality. But for some reason, there's a disconnect, you know, when you're in your 20s that you are going to get old and that, older and that, you know, when you hit those decade marks in, you know, in your 30s, it's going to be a little, you know, maybe not a huge degree, but it's going to be more difficult to get in shape. You know, your metabolism's going to be slowing down. It's, you know, you're not going to be able to run around the hills, as easily without that preseason conditioning. And then when you get in your 40s, it becomes a little more exacerbated. And I can only imagine, you know, as I'm going to be hitting my 50s here pretty soon, that I'm going to see that transition even a little bit more abruptly. And I think you've probably got somewhere around a decade ahead of me. And why don't you speak a little bit to our younger listeners as far as, you know, maybe what you're doing to preserve your body, kind of what your, how your, the thought process has changed over the last 30 years, as far as what you do to kind of make sure that you're going to be able to do this into your 70s.
No, I agree. When you're young, you're invincible, and you really don't think about that. And you're these, 50s and 60s are a long way away, and you think, well, that's, I'm not going to worry about it. But as you know, I am a little more than a decade older than you, and I have found that I have to work much harder at it to stay in shape year round, not just 2 weeks, 3 weeks before season. I'll go on a couple runs and climb a hill and call it good. I work every week year round to stay in shape, to climb, you know, these mountains at altitude, and it in my 50s is where I really noticed it starting to get more difficult to stay in shape. And so I work hard to eat right, get plenty of sleep, and try not to let stress get too much of you. You know, it's hard, you can't avoid it completely, but do your best to, because I think that really is tough on your body. Mm-hmm. And we live close to a ski area where in the winter there's a group of older guys that we skin up the mountain. In other words, we put this synthetic skins on and hike up the ski area before it opens, and you can go anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 vertical feet. Great workout.
Holy cow,
before work, and ski down and have a cup of coffee and a donut and feel like you did something. So mm-hmm. that's a great way to stay in shape in the winter for me, and that's what I do. And then, like now, Sunday, I put 25 pound the sand in my backpack in a little sandbag, and climbed one of the ridges close by. And so I'll start doing that to stay in shape, because there is, I honestly feel for Western mountain hunting, it is the biggest factor to success, is being in shape. I think it's more important than what bow you shoot, what broadhead you shoot, or even, you know, other than the most important thing is to go where game is. You know, you can't get one if there's nothing there. Second most important thing is to be in shape and to be fit and to have stamina.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, one of the, it's kind of interesting. So last year, coming up to, I think it was in February, when things really started to pile up for me work wise, and then I was getting ready to move out here to Colorado, and I had been, you know, a pretty solid couple years doing a really steady, rigorous fitness program. And, you know, down there at sea level, where I lived in Northern California before I moved out here to Colorado, and I was seeing, you know, I was feeling big gains from that, from a fitness standpoint, and how that translated into my performance, and comfort and success on the mountain. And then I spent, I just now really started getting back into it this last week and a half or so, where I had the community center here in Estes just opened. They built a huge facility, and it's got an indoor track and a bunch of fitness equipment and all that. And so I just, in the last 9 days, kind of started hitting it again, but it was kind of interesting. So from February into hunting season, I had done zero physical fitness preparation, but just moving from sea level up to 7,500 feet, I noticed a huge difference in my cardio on the mountain. And I didn't have the benefit, of course, of having done the physical fitness from a muscle standpoint, preparation standpoint, but just from a cardio standpoint, living at, you know, 7,500 feet as opposed to sea level, I saw a huge difference. And, you know, if you're coming from near sea level and you're not doing some degree of physical preparation, man, you are going to feel it when you, especially if you're mule deer hunting, you know, where you're up, you know, above that. I really notice a difference myself, you know, from say 7,000 feet to 10,000 feet. I see a huge difference, you know, at from that 10,000 feet to 12,000 foot difference. How about you?
Yeah, I really do. I really do. Right about, we live at 8,500 feet, and the difference is huge when you're lucky enough to live at altitude, because your body gets used to it. So, but at 12,000 feet, I can, there's like a little wall there, mm-hmm. that, I think from 10 to 12, you notice it, but at 12, all of a sudden, whoa, you know, and makes a big difference. And that, having that cardio fitness is huge climbing those mountains. It's just probably, again, just one of the single most important things you can do is whatever you can do, run bleachers, ride a bike, swim, get that cardio fitness going.
Yeah, that was funny. The buck that I shot at the highest elevation, I remember on my stock, I went through a saddle that was at 13,600 feet. And from where I glassed him, you know, I hustled around and did the backdoor approach on him. And I was, you know, one of those deals trying to, you know, go as fast as I could while I had him out of my sight. And I had to climb up this rock slide, to that 13,600 foot saddle. And I was laughing because I was so out of breath. And that was in one of those situations where I'd come from sea level, you know, and straight up there to elevation. And it was just like, I could not get my breath. And it was, you know, one or two, it was a couple of steps up. It was an extremely steep hillside and I was just huffing and puffing. It was like, good grief. I'm going to be lucky if I make it to the top, let alone make it with any kind of speed.
Yeah. It's, definitely takes it out of you. It's great though. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Up in that high altitude.
No doubt. Here's another opportune segue for guys that are coming or live back east or you know, maybe wanting to come out and do a summer scouting trip and get themselves you know, up at elevation. The Colorado Traditional Archery Association has a shoot the third weekend in June every year called the High Country Shoot. And I've made it there a couple of times and man, what a blast. And you are one of the people that kind of helps organize and put that shoot together. Why don't you, for the people who either aren't familiar with it or have never been to it, why don't you give them a little bit of background on that shoot and why they should come out to it?
Sure. It's my favorite shoot. And I've been going to shoots and competing starting in California for over 30 years. And it's just in a great location up in the Aspens in the White River National Forest above Newcastle. And I'm on the board of directors, so I help kind of keep the ball rolling. This shoot, I think, is in its 25th year. Started out with about 80 traditional archers. And is last year we had a little over 600 shooters. It's starts always the weekend after Father's Day, and we'll go up pretty much a week ahead of time and set up three 3D courses, and then there'll be aerial shoots and American round. We have water balloon shoot and vendors and you know, a little bit of food, and just a great time of camaraderie and everybody getting together and, you know, year after year seeing each other. And there's two competitive rounds, a Fred Bear round and a called a three arrow round, where you can only take three arrows, and if you miss, that arrow's gone, so you're allowed three misses and then you're out. So that's for the guys that like to score and have some competition. The rest of us just for fun and just walking through the Aspens and up and down the hills and the mountain air and 11 Alaska Range, and with all Alaskan animals, and then a kind of a western range. Where there's a kids' dinosaur range. We really work hard to engage the kids and families. There's plenty of camping. It's right at, I think, 8,000 feet. So it does get you up where you'll get a little bit acclimated and a chance to get out. And it's, you know, as the aspens are leaving, it really is a great, great adventure and a great time. I love it up there.
Yeah, it's basically, you know, a shoot in the setting of elk country, as far as I mean, you could just as easily be elk hunting as you would be out there shooting 3D targets. And, from a, you know, so from a practice standpoint, you can't beat it in that respect. And, the shoot has been growing pretty rapidly the last few years as far as attendance, hasn't it?
Yes, it really has. Started out, you know, like I say, from I think about 80, and then grew to a couple hundred, and then I think 5 years ago we had 400, and then it's really shot up into the 600 shooters, you know, number. And we've had shooters from Australia, from Italy, from England. It's really grown, and the word has spread, and it really is a great time. And you can just shoot till your fingers fall off.
Right.
And you really do feel like you're hunting, especially if you kind of get up early in the morning and there's mist and you're walking through the aspens and then there's an elk target there. You just really feel like, man, this is cool. This is like hunting.
Yeah. So for somebody who's interested in attending that's coming from out of the area, like you had pointed out, you can camp there down in Newcastle. They do have hotels available. Isn't that right?
I think they do. You know, I've never paid too much attention to it, but really the best experience is to get up there camping and hanging out at the campfire and meeting new friends and, you know, seeing we have a lot of raffles and a lot of different events going on in the evenings. The shoot is actually Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, so we're able to start shooting about 12 on Thursday once the ranges are all cleared. And then we close up Sunday about 11 in the morning to get time to pull all the targets and get all cleaned up and get everybody back home.
So one of the things, too, is I know that they have dinner available on the – do they do dinner every night, or is it just like Friday and Saturday night that they are selling dinners and then lunches as well, right?
You know, we've actually pretty much done away with the food.
Oh, really?
Other than some coffee and rolls in the morning. It just got to be too difficult, and we were losing too much money on it. We are working to get a vendor up there that will have lunch and dinner available. And so that's our goal, is to have somebody that will provide food. But until that's been finalized, I say bring your own food.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good to know, because I got to come up with an empty cooler.
Yep.
All right.
Yeah, we'd feed.
Yeah. All right. No starvation setting in, huh?
No.
Yeah. And I wanted to emphasize that this is a very family-friendly shoot. I mean, like you had pointed out, the kids, there's a great kids range. There's kids running around all over the place. A really great family type of atmosphere for sure.
Yes, and that's the main emphasis, is to make it fun for families and for kids, and for kids to win some raffles and you know, different ranges for different age groups and different little events going on, an aerial target, a water balloon shoot, a jug shoot. And then there's some great instruction. Usually Tom Klum will come up from Rocky Mountain Specialty Gear and do a shooting clinic. So we have blanket trading, you know, a lot of the bowyers such as yourself come, and you can look at bows and try bows and have the opportunity to test them out. And so it really is, I mean, just something that we look forward to year after year. And it's really fun.
From a vendor standpoint, do you know approximately how many you had there last year?
I'd say we had a dozen vendors.
Okay. Yeah, that's kind of what I was going to make a stab at as far as the guest goes. And yeah, like you said, I'll be there this year. Tom Klum had, you know, a pretty good setup there from Rocky Mountain Specialties. And there was a number of other Boyers, or are a number of other Boyers there, and people selling accessories and some non-related archery related stuff. But yeah, I was a really, really fun time. And I know that the people that have come, have, you know, always sworn they'll be back every year. And I think Selway comes out, or is planning on coming out this year. They've been pretty consistent there, right?
Yep. Yeah. We just got the registration forms online, and you can find those at, collotradarchers.com, coloradotradarchers.com. If anybody's interested to learn a little bit about it, and my number and my wife's number's on there, and some of the other board members, always happy to take a phone call and talk if anybody has any questions.
Yeah, I mean, flying from anywhere in the country into Denver and then renting a car is not too terribly cost prohibitive, and that may seem excessive, you know, for a shoot. But if you thought maybe even about making a you know, scouting trip while you're at it, some of that high country may be still buried in snow, but you know, that is a possibility there also. At least getting familiar with road systems and kind of, you know, looking at the mountains, and just even if you just make it out for the shoot, it's a really, really enjoyable time.
Yeah, it really is. We get a big group from California. We got a group from Nevada, Arizona, Wyoming, Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, all the surrounding states will get a good showing of people. So it really is just a great time to get together with archers and meet new people. And I've learned some great hunting buddies. And some of these guys are the real deal when it comes to hunters. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, good deal, Scott. I appreciate your time here on the podcast, and I'm sure that there's going to be a lot of people that you know, are going to appreciate the information that you helped you know, provide there on planning, you know, an elk hunt or mule deer hunt coming into Colorado. And I hope that a lot of people, you know, kind of their ears perk up about the high country shoot and put that on their calendar for this year.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Enjoy talking with you.
Sure thing.
Okay.
Good deal. All right. Well, good luck this season and good luck in the draws this year. And I should have mentioned that you already pulled a Arizona elk tag. So you're already starting out good this year on the draws.
I did. I'm pretty excited about it. Getting ready to go down there and do some scouting and studying the maps. It's great. I like this time of year. I like the draws. It's a little like Christmas waiting to see what you got, you know, so
yeah,
it's
definitely
great. Fun.
Good deal.
All righty.
All right, Scott, appreciate your time.
Great talking with you. Thanks.
Likewise. Uh-huh. Bye.
If you've enjoyed listening to the Western Bowhunter podcast, please subscribe to the show so that you will automatically be notified when new episodes are posted up. Please take the time to give us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. This will help us in the podcast rankings and will help us grow. If you have a topic you'd like to hear about or a guest that you'd like to hear from in a future episode, email south@stalkerstickbows.com with podcast in the subject line.
Too many years have passed me by. I've gone down.